Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, welcome to Digital Divination, episode 47.
Oh, moving up there.
Yeah, we are so close to 50 now. You know, there's a while there. I remember, you know, you were talking, you were going out of town for vacation. I said, oh, you know, we could just skip one. He said, oh, no, we can't do that. We're too new. That was like episode 26 or something, right? He said, oh, we're too new. And so now I'm like, oh, you know, we're so close to 50. We got to power through.
We have to get that. I mean, shoot, we just... through. Should we just do three right now? Nobody would know, yes. Right? That yes. Oh, I don't know. Maybe they would. When suddenly we're talking about things that are 6 weeks old, maybe they would realize that we're.
Yeah, we're pretty current. You know, I don't know if you recognize it. Normally we don't record this late in the week.
Yeah, this is news. This is a schedule change, right? I hope, is this good or bad? You know how network TV used to move shows around to get better or worse time slots, and people were like, oh, you don't want to get it in the Friday evening time slot when nobody's watching TV. That's terrible. That's a kiss of death for a show. Is this good news or bad news, John? What do you think?
Well, I don't know about you. I don't know if you remember like when Cheers was on and some of those other big shows, they were in the mm-hmm. Thursday night time slot. That's the big time slot for TV Thursday night. We're the Thursday night.
All righty. Yeah. It's us. It's us or Dallas, I guess. That's the.
No, I don't know if people know what these things we're talking about. Yeah. So they flip flopped. So our Intrepid Heroes moved to Monday instead of Friday. So it starts off the week. And then Digital Divination moved to Thursday off of Tuesday. And that was to facilitate a couple other shows that were coming on and schedules with Parham and doing stuff. Ryan asked me, is it okay if we move things around? And, you know, I said, sure, that's fine. And actually moving this further off the weekend, I think is helpful because we're trying to decide, are we going to record Saturday, Sunday, or do it really late on Monday?
On Monday, and, right.
Yeah. And it's like, well, Tuesday, I like this Tuesday. I have like, tomorrow's an off day for me. I got all day to edit and do stuff. And so,
well, good. Well, we have a lot more flexibility. And I guess that, is that going to mean we're a lot more professional in our delivery? Well, probably not. But we have more time to be us. That's the issue. I want to give a quick role-playing focused mention. I mentioned Dallas, right? The TV show.
Yeah.
That ties into role-playing games in a way you might not realize. Early on, one thing that is fairly common now in role-playing games is they license properties, right? So you get a Star Trek role-playing game or the Expanse role-playing game,
whatever.
That was, at some point, that was brand new. That was something that they hadn't done in role-playing games. Some of the very earliest role-playing game licensed properties were based on the works of Clark Ashton Smith, who is a kind of a Weird Tales sort of author. There was one that was on Elric, the Stormbringer. There was a license.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the very earliest ones was Dallas, the role-playing game based on the TV show. Of all the licensed properties to have picked, I suppose grabbing something at the top of the cultural zeitgeist at the time was probably smart. But in retrospect, it seems a really weird choice.
To make a
soap opera role-playing game.
Yeah, an evening soap opera kind of thing is a role-playing game. I mean, maybe they were trying to appeal to, like, middle-aged
television TV watchers of any kind. Yeah.
I don't know. Honestly, I never watched Dallas, so that wasn't my thing.
Now, and I was too young to do anything except pick up sort of what was in the zeitgeist. Who killed J.R. Ewing was the big question.
Right.
Everybody knew that question, even if you never watched the show. And that's was my limit of my knowledge. But I was reading something the other day that called to mind the Dallas RPG. And I knew that it existed, but I didn't realize it was at the forefront of licensed properties way, way back in the initial days.
That's pretty cool. You know, I interviewed Steve Jackson last year from Steve Jackson Games, and he's got this the Munchkin line that he does for products, and he's licensing all kinds of properties for that. You know, Disney properties, Starfinder's one. He's got, you know, D&D stuff. And I'm just amazed. You know, they just take their gaming system, then apply a property to it, and people like to buy it and play it. I think it's kind of a neat model.
Yeah, you can. I mean, that's it's a good route to success. I was playing some board games with friends the other day. I don't know if you've ever played or heard of a delightful game called Marrying Mr. Darcy.
But I know what it's about.
Yeah, it's Pride and Prejudice. And you play the women in the story, and as you play the game, you collect wit, beauty, and friendliness and reputation, and event cards might make you gain or lose some of those. But the point of the game is to earn enough points. So in the end game, when this various men in the novel are available to be married, that you make the best marriage for yourself as possible. Mm. And that's how you get points, and that's how you win. It's delightful. One of the most delightful things about it in my personal experience is my wife and I love introducing it to people. And we were talking to my friend Connor, who is enormous. I mean, he's like 6'8 and 400 pounds. He's just a human huge scale. And his wife is very small. And so they're an interesting couple. So we're talking about, they're over for games one day. How about we play this game based on Pride and Prejudice? Have you heard of it? And Connor looks me dead in the eye and says, "Oh, I know that game." And his wife kind of gives a, "Oh," and Connor's like, "And I've never lost that game." I'm like, "What?" And his wife's like, "Yeah, we played it like 6 or 7 times and Connor always wins. This huge guy is always winning this, you know, this, you know, this romance game." And so we played, and Connor won. That was kind of a no surprise to anybody. Wow. But anyway, I've delayed on this point because one of the things that really strikes me about the game is how adaptable that is. The underlying mechanics of the game are really easy to pick up and could just as easily apply if you had a game about Warhammer 40K, right? You're like, "Oh, well, I'm playing the Tyranids card. I'm playing the Space Marines team, and we're trying to get, you know, whatever resources you want from the game." Or you could do like an action movie, or you could do, I mean, it could fit any number of genres. And I feel like Munchkin is that way. It is a card game that is so easily adaptable to so many different genres when you reskin it that it's super smart to be licensing it that way.
And you know, and talking to them, the cost of the licenses, I was surprised, you know, that Disney license, Harry Potter and stuff like that, they weren't so crazy expensive that they couldn't afford to do it.
I would expect that to be millions. Is it not millions and millions? I mean, I assume he didn't say.
No, but I that's the first thing I said. "Wow, you're getting Disney and all this stuff. That's gotta be crazy." He goes, "No, actually, for this kind of thing, apparently it's not that much." I don't know. Maybe trying to broaden the appeal to other generations and things. I'm not quite sure. Interesting guy. That game, you know, my wife is a huge Pride and Prejudice, Jane Austen, you know, all those things from that kind of era fan. Mm-hmm. And she's not a fan of role-playing games. I would like to introduce her to that.
We should do it. It is enjoyable. We have the Emma expansion, which I've refused to even open until I read Emma. Yeah, and my wife is convincing me, "Oh, well, you've seen the movie Clueless," which is basically the plot of Emma. And I'm like, I want to get the original. We also have the expansion they did, which is Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. It adds weapons and zombies to the game, which is fun. I mean, it's just kind of a delight all the way around.
Awesome. Who makes that? Who's the developer for that?
Man, that is a good question, and it's not within reach on my shelf here. I actually picked it up from the woman who created it. She created it. Her husband did a lot of the art, which is kind of delightful and of the time. But she was selling it at a convention that a friend of mine and I went to, and she was just out demoing it. My friend and I sat down and I'm like, "This is a delight." So it's one of those situations where I'm like, "This is so good." I immediately bought a copy for myself and like 3 other copies to give out as gifts to people that I knew would love it. So Wow. Yeah, but I'll bring our copy over the next time we're able to get together, and you know, maybe we'll play. That'd be fun.
That sounds good. Yes, okay. But it doesn't sound digital at all.
I think we need Starfinder.
Yes, we need to shift gears a little bit, Ron.
Okay, we can do that.
So new year, and we started a new game. Actually, January 2nd, we did our first recorded our first episode for our new AP, Devastation Arc. Is it the Devastation Arc or just Devastation Arc?
I believe it is just Devastation Arc.
Yeah.
And I don't want to speak on behalf of the Starfinder AP team, but the Pathfinder AP team has had a great deal of pride in our tradition of not ever starting an AP title with the word the. Yes. I mean, we've just never done
that's
it.
That's good.
I think Starfinder has kept it up. I don't know that they've started any Adventure Path title with the individual volumes might, but so that's why I can say with some confidence it is Devastation Arc, not the Devastation Arc.
All right. But we started that, and yes. You had some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I thought it could have been better. The kickoff and yeah. It's entirely on me, because here's the mistake that I made. Here's my thinking. My thinking was, I'm getting all of us are getting together. Right, you know, I'm kicking off as a GM. I want my friends to have fun. So I want to get into the action, right? I want to get through the exposition that kind of kicks the adventure path off, and then get right into the action and the weird environment in which the first one is set. And kind of an impressive combat. Turned out to be none too hard, but it's kind of a, you know, good get the dice hitting the table and get playing.
Right.
But in the course of doing that, I kind of rushed past, tell me about your characters, right? And that's kind of a critical part of any time you're starting a campaign, is to let people who've put some real thought into who they're going to be playing have some time in front of all their friends to talk about that. And this is regardless of the type of role player that you are, having that moment is important. If you're the kind of person who delves deeply into a backstory and you want to be all mysterious and, you know, you've got names for your characters, you know, relatives and past employers and stuff, and you're just deep into the story, you want some time to present that story to people. If you're the kind of person who's really into mechanics, right? You're like, oh, and I can do this awesome thing when somebody gets sickened, or I can do this awesome thing to keep us from, you know, taking fire damage or whatever, right? Get letting them effuse a little bit about what's cool about the mechanics, because that's what they've liked. Anyway, giving everybody a few minutes to sort of present themselves is really important. And I realized we didn't do that sort of in the first little bit. And we were kind of off and running, and people were kind of, wait a minute, who's your character again? And I realized I hadn't given people that opportunity. And so we did, we ended up doing the presentation of our characters. But the thing that struck me about that is it was just as important for people who'd been playing the same characters all along. Two people in our group are playing the same characters they have been for 11 levels now, 13 levels now. And so it was just as important for them to be able to talk about not only this is who I am, but this is how I've changed.
Right.
And that, you know, not, and so giving people that sort of space to be able to talk about that is an important part at the beginning of any campaign. I think it's also helpful to do whenever there is a shift in the characters of the campaign. I've noticed a couple of times in campaigns that I've run where somebody has a character that dies or whatever in the middle of a fight, and then they bring in another character. And it's like people hardly notice, right? Like, you know, they refer to the player as their old character's name and stuff like that. I'm like, you know, you need to have sort of the, you know, the backup marquee moment where everybody describes who they are. And I feel like not only is that important at the outset of a game, but whenever there's character changes mid-game, probably a good time to have people kind of go around the table and then have those explanation moments again. And even if the way you're doing your explanation moment is, I'm Vargrim the dwarf fighter, just like I've always been. But now Vargrim really hates ghouls because of that ghoul encounter. Remember that, guys? Ugh.
Right.
You know, and letting people sort of enjoy that on a more regular basis through the campaign. Anyway, that was a big lesson that I got from that. So,
yeah. I remember when we actually one of our players stepped back and said, "Wait a second, we didn't do this thing."
Yeah,
and it,
right.
It hadn't occurred to me, and I was just thinking as you're going through this, what happened? And you know, we had a session zero where we all talked about, introduced each other, talked about kind of the character that we were looking to make, and then there was a little discussion online, but we never really went through the character. So everybody kind of knew what classes they were bringing in. You know, we had the names, you know, put up before the game. So people kind of knew that, but you're right. A lot of people didn't really know. And what's different about this is that we weren't all starting at level one, given that this is a high level AP, the existing players were level 13 already. And then, the three new players that came in, is that right? Four new players that came in were all built from scratch up to level 13. And that's a huge, huge, you know, change from just a basic level one that doesn't have a lot of special things to now level 13 that you're pretty much getting near the top of all the stuff you can do right. And all the cool things and interactive stuff and equipment and all that. And, you know, somebody who I was introducing a new class here that was not in the core class of Vanguard. We had somebody bring in a biohacker, which is again not a core class, has lots of things they can do. It actually, and for me, so many things I had a hard time keeping track of them all, you know.
Right. So you're really thrown into the deep end at high level. Yeah, we've talked on this very show about what makes high level play different, and having to keep track of lots of things is one of the points we made. But you were living it at this first session where you're like, oh, I think I could reduce some of the damage. Wait,
right.
No, I can't actually. No, that's if it happens to me. And then after the combat, you're like, oh, actually, no, I did find the way I could do it to you.
Yeah. Well, one of the issues, because of the way I built the character, it has multiple ways to aid the party. But there's always, they're all conditional on different things. And I built it all in roll 20, which is what we're using, rather than building out a full character sheet where it would have it all easy to find. Mm-hmm. And in roll 20, I'm scrolling through things, trying to find it, you know, and it's like, I need to do better. So, you know, I was thinking other interesting things. We had a party mostly that had all played together. And so one of the things that was happening in there is we were making a lot of references to previous players and what they would have done. You know, previous characters, but we had a new player in the game who wasn't privy to all that. And I was feeling a little bad in that respect.
Oh, a little bit of sort of, you know, in not in jokes necessarily, but in references that can make other people feel. Yeah. Then there's actually not only is it polite to guard against doing that if you've got a new person at the table, but it's also probably in our best interest as being people who are podcasting this to not lean too heavily on that. We want to, one thing that really frustrates me about jumping in to like listening to people actual play stuff is when they're making a lot of, I'm like, oh, I don't get any of that. I haven't listened to the first part of that or the prior season. I had a new friend of mine recently suggest Critical Role, listening to Critical Role. And I've had other friends recommend Critical Role. And she was saying that now is a great time because they just switched over their campaign and they're so far not talking about a lot of the old stuff. So this is a good place for new people to get in. And I realized at the time, I'm like, oh, that's smart to, I mean, as much as you want to make people who have been listeners all along feel included, you can't rely on that. You have to know new people are coming in and give good entry points, new inroads for people who are joining. So,
Yeah, and also I think in terms of allowing the new person to express themselves, show themselves how they fit in and everything, you know, by all the players kind of taking on that perspective of that, you know, we all have to show the newness about us in here and focus on that rather than the historical stuff, I do think it makes it a little bit easier. And our new person, in this case, Eleanor Farron, She did an awesome job. I loved actually her role playing and the character development and stuff she did. And I think she really sets a good example for the rest of us on how we can do stuff. You can tell why she's such a good author and developer, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. I think there might be some experience that we have with that other people might not necessarily have, because both you and I have done an awful lot of organized play where mm-hmm. you end up sitting with tables full of people you've never met before all the time. And you might think that you've got, you know, the kind of the best damage dealing character out there. You're like, I've played at, you know, 15 tables and I'm always out damaging people because of my clever build, but you never know if the very next table, you can't advertise yourself. And I'm the one who does more damage than everybody else, because the person sitting next to you might be, oh really? I figured out this other thing. So you kind of have to present yourself in more generalities. You're like, well, I'm a frontliner and I do lots of damage. Or you might even say, I really load up the damage or something like that. But you can't really speak in superlatives. And it was interesting to me to hear people talking about their characters and avoiding superlatives in that regard. My character can really help with X, or my character's really bad at Y. But the players don't yet know what they're like in relation to each other. And that's something that only play experience is going to show.
Yeah, and everybody creating new characters, I'm thinking from my own experience, there was discussion, we introduced our new operative, right? We have an operative in there, and Eleanor made a comment on how overpowered they are and how much damage they're going to do. And it's like, well, you know, our experience has been at the higher levels, yeah, the operatives do good damage, but man, we had a soldier that was just like whacking things, you know, and our Solarian, man, she was just killing it. So people's experience, you know, with different players and different characters is going to vary dramatically. And they're, you know, what I would really want to see is for Eleanor to get the perception that, you know what, maybe the operative isn't the end all and be all here when we get to high level play, you know?
Yeah, that might be the case. Well, I don't know. They probably are, but we'll get to that. One of the things that I really like about Rob, who's playing the operative, he was not sort of, you know, tweaking his mystic to be overtuned, powerful as possible. He was just like, you know, I want to play the character and have a couple of reliable things I do. And that's kind of, and then I'm happy. Right. And I feel like he's going to be playing his operative probably very much the same way. Yep. And, you know, so I think that'll actually be a good way to have an operative fit maybe better if the class is tuned a little more powerful than having Rob or anybody who is sort of a much more character driven than numbers driven kind of player could actually be a real boon to playing that class. So,
well, and I think, you know, I noticed like with our biohacker, I think Mark is getting much more into the role play aspect of it. I want to get much more into the role play aspect of my Vanguard. I'm thinking, you know, the previous game, you know, or previous podcasts, a lot of it, you know, we're jumping in and doing stuff, seeing what we can do. Now we know a bit more about how the game works, the mechanics and things. I'm hoping this is a bit more relaxing and more fun role play and less concerned about, well, like our last AP book where Jason was like throwing the kitchen sink at us.
Oh, yeah. That was a real trial by fire, no pun intended. But we hadn't had that before in the campaign, as tough as it was sort of refreshing and new in that way. And that was kind of neat. There might be some lesson in there about varying, if you're a GM, varying the tone and weight of your encounters to kind of keep things lively and interesting.
Well, I will, I don't want to make a lot of spoilers on this, but I'll say, I'm actually running that book for this other Sunday group that I was talking to you about. They're finishing that up. And I just ran the first session of it on this past Sunday, a couple of days ago. And man, it's actually now reading how it's written, Jason changed it a lot.
He promised he would, right? That was, and I guess any GM can and should, but you know, as the author, I wonder I think that probably a lot of it is a response to the play of the table, right? He's like, yes. Oh, these people, yes. You know, they've built up so big. They want to bring the pain. I can bring the pain. And that was, great. But I wonder how much of it also is, well, as the author, this was kind of my vision for how it was supposed to go. And now I can actually live my vision. I've done that plenty of times when I'm running something that I wrote. I'm like, oh, well, here's the mood that maybe didn't get across in the writing that I really want to put forth. So.
Well, I kind of looked at a couple of things that he changed to look at the reasoning. And I think, you know, the flavor of the opponent was one way, but there were certain limits on their abilities to do things that he kind of relaxed. Okay. And when he did that, it really made a huge challenge for us that otherwise really wasn't there. And I, quite frankly, I enjoyed as a player those challenges, having to fight through it. I'm running a party of four through that, running it as written. Honestly, they haven't had any problem.
Oh, really? It
was written. Yeah, it's nothing. Stuff that caused us all kinds of headache. When I'm running it as written, things that he was allowing it to do at will are actually like once a day and stuff like that.
Well, he was also surprised. One of my favorite parts about when he was running was to realize that we'd made it all the way to 11th level. And he's kind of looking around in the first couple of fights. After the first couple of fights, he's like, wait a minute. How are you guys not all equipped with cold weapons, weapons that do cold damage.
Yes.
Having spent five full adventures in a campaign that takes place in the sun against flaming opponents. And we're all just sort of like, I don't know. I like my sonic weapon. You know,
also you're in the sun and they typically aren't making cold weapons in the sun.
That's true. That's true. So. Why wouldn't they? Right. They'd be the most lethal things you could make, but, I don't know. Yeah. At any rate, I think that he at that point realized that, we had a lot we could do, but we weren't as completely ready to overwhelm as a party. Does your group that's running it, are they now very well equipped with cold weapons that do weapons and other things that do cold damage or no?
No, same as us. Most Sonic seems very popular in part because it seems to cover a lot of ground and there's not a ton of Sonic immunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's just like with us. I noticed that they had, their two main damage dealers were doing Sonic damage. So, but getting this kind of back onto what, starting up and I guess lessons learned, you talked about kind of the introduction part, which, by the way, we did go back and do, and I'm going to edit back in earlier on. So,
okay. So when that comes out in a few months, people will see that sooner than we actually played it.
Yes. Yeah. So hopefully that works out. Okay. As a GM though, what were some of the things you had to do differently? Introducing a new player, bringing in two existing players, and then three people, but with different characters, three of the same players, but with different characters.
Oh, I guess it's fair to say there's probably little I did differently than I would do to a whole other group. I think that it's probably pretty common as sort of established gaming groups go. You hear about, we're the same group of people who've been playing for 30 years with the same group of us. That's super rare. I feel like having people kind of drop out and then come in sort of over time is pretty typical. So I feel like I'm not working with any, I feel like I'm not breaking new ground there. I feel like the way of, well, let's make references to, some of the shorthand we picked up as a group that might be helpful. If I wanted to say that somebody was really focused on using grenades, and I was speaking to Eleanor, right? I'd say, oh, so-and-so is super into using grenades. Whereas what I would say it to, you, I might say, oh, just like Jula Koshti. And you would know that means is good with grenades and loves watching stuff blow up. But other than having that sort of social references that we can use, it's kind of a lot like we'd be bringing any kind of group together. Any group of friends would be very much the same if I knew some people from, not even from role playing, from board gaming, right? And somebody who always wants to pick the you know, whenever there's some sort of board game we're playing and they're like, always, I want to be whatever's the, you know, high stealth or sneaky character that if we're picking characters for this board game, like, oh, well, of course he's a rogue, mm-hmm. just like so-and-so would play.
Right.
And everybody gets it. So I think that that's sort of helps build in the conversation. One of the things that I'm trying to get better at is knowing that a campaign is going to introduce elements of the game world that are somewhat common knowledge and mm-hmm. kind of putting those at the front end so we don't have to spend a lot of time going over those when they actually show up. And the mm-hmm. example for Devastation Arc, which I think is not spoiler because the picture is right on the front cover of the first one, is a Bantrid, you know, these nose-looking right. aliens with a big rollerball they go around on. People in the world have seen that. They would know what that is, you know, saying, oh, well, that's a Bantrid is, you know, even if they haven't met a whole lot of them in person, they're going to kind of just know what one is.
Right.
And so being able at the beginning to say, oh, this is a Bantrid, when it comes up, here's what a Bantrid is. Mm-hmm. And some of those sort of aspects, right? Pointing out, well, this is a world that's actually, it's in the core rule book. You can read about it in the core rule book.
Right, right.
Is sort of helpful grounding for the players that both, it does two things. One, it saves some time later on when that comes up. And secondly, it might put a sense of somebody to build their character in a way to have a closer connection to that. Does somebody mm-hmm. be like, oh, well, what do Bantrids speak? Well, they probably speak Breathaden, I think, probably. Okay, well, I'm mm-hmm. thinking Breathaden as a language. Oh, that'll mm-hmm. be convenient when Bantrids show up, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did appreciate that part, you know, where you kind of explained a couple things. In referencing it back to the core rule book, I thought it was really kind of neat in that you had given a description, and then we read in the core rule book, and it mapped up right exactly with it. So,
phew! Oh,
almost exactly as if somebody who was writing this might have used that as a reference. I don't know. Is that how it works?
As the example, we do exactly that. Yeah. I just for the Abomination Vaults game, I brought down my Lost Omens world guide book to show. I hadn't done it before in the campaign, but now I realized mm-hmm. that I could. To show a map of the part of the world with the town you guys are in right there on it, right? I'm not we're not making this town up. It's part of mm-hmm. the world already. We're expanding on what's there. So mm-hmm. it was mm-hmm. a delight, but not a surprise to see that the developers for Devastation Arc have done the same.
Mm-hmm. What about getting a group ready for high level play here, introducing it? Because I think, you know, for all of us, the highest we played up to was level 13. Has Eleanor played up that high with a character, Starfinder?
I don't know. My suspicion is no. My suspicion is that she has not. One of the things that I feel like having so many tools in your toolbox as a high-level character, mm-hmm. that the best mm-hmm. way to get into that, and this is something that the Devastation Arc Adventure Path does really well, is to start with combats that are varied but not overwhelmingly tough, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be like, oh, well, when I go up against undead, I can kind of learn, oh, this is my stuff that's particularly good against undead. All right, well, I'm learning that. And oh, well, here's an encounter where mobility matters. You're like, oh, okay, well, now I'm, oh, you've got a force pack, but you've only got jump jets, and here's how that might matter, right? I feel trying to arrange encounters that sort of let people learn their new high level characters' abilities over mm-hmm. time, rather than having to throw yourself into it all at once, is probably the best way to get people sort of not only up to speed on their own characters, but also to learn what other people can do. So, mm-hmm. you know, five, six sessions down the road, when, you know, you got another fight with undead, people are like, oh, you had that one spell that totally mowed through the undead that first time we fought them. Put it, you know, use that. What's that like? So.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, we haven't played at this level and above. And so when I was designing this character, I was kind of basing it around. Now, I have a level 13 Vanguard already, but I haven't played it a lot. And so mm-hmm. I quite honestly, I didn't think a whole lot about it when I put it together. When I was building this character, initially I was going to make it a soldier vanguard, but then I realized the synergies, and this is for most classes, the synergies of the skills that you have really build well upon themselves at the higher levels. And when I was going to make it 3 levels of soldier, 10 levels of vanguard, I was getting some good stuff, but really I was missing out on a couple key things. One of them that you get at level 13.
If you had been just straight vanguard all the way through.
So I just decided just to go straight vanguard all the way through, because it actually enabled me to do cooler things. And then the like one or two cool things I wanted to do, I could try to, you know, with the soldier levels, I could put some of that in. And then what if I just had to forego, right? I said, okay, well, I can't do that. That's okay. But I can do these other cooler things. And so it really got me thinking at the really high levels, the way our classes are structured, and at least up to maybe level 16 or so, that there is, it looks like a pretty strong benefit just to go straight one class, pure class, up to a certain point because of those strong synergies. And I'm thinking, you know, with casters getting higher level spells, you know, with Vanguard and soldiers, just getting certain things when you reach those higher levels that, you know, if you don't have 16 or 17 levels, then you can't get that thing. Yeah. That, wow, this is really cool. And so instead of like the society play where I'm organically growing all the way up, here I'm thinking, what do I want to be like when I hit level 19? So I'm assuming we hit level 20 when we finish the AP. So when we're doing the final boss in that last book and I'm level 19, what do I want to be able to do? That's the perspective I took when I decided to sit down and crank it out. And that's a lot different than, oh, how would I build this so it'd be cool at level 13?
I see. Let me first say that how cruel would it be to have a game that advertises taking you all the way to 20 and not let you play with your 20th level powers for at least some part of the adventure? So yeah, you will be adventuring at 20th level for some part of it. So keep that in mind. Yeah. Right there is a reason to be sticking with one class.
Yeah, because there's a cool thing at level 20 for everybody.
Everybody gets some cool capstone thing.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's interesting for me to hear that you made that decision, because I feel like people who organically play characters in a long-running campaign, they have a real inertia tends to keep them with the same class, right? Like, well, you know, I figured out what a mechanic does. I'm going to take another level of mechanic, right? And there might be people who want to dabble, or they're like, oh, I really want to pick up these things that, you know, a Solarian has maybe or something. But for the most part, I feel like a lot of characters are like, look, you know, I chose to play the mechanic. I'm the mechanic guy in the party. And whenever somebody needs computers or engineering, they're looking to me. I'm just going to keep right on being the mechanic, because that's a thing I know, the thing I picked and a thing I know. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting for me to hear that if you didn't have inertia, it is still a good choice, looking at it from a very dispassionate perspective, maybe, that taking all your levels in one class still works. There's a lot of good reason for that. So,
well, and I agree with what you're saying in terms of inertia. I think that the difference is that when I was picking what I could do as a Vanguard up to level 13, I was saying, well, let's try this. I didn't have some solid concept where I want to be at level 20, because I don't quite frankly expect this Vanguard ever to make it to level 20 through society play, right? You know, just kind of offhand. So with this one, I knew I was going to get to that end state one way or the other. And so I was a lot more careful. It's like, you know, I used to play, like 3.5 on a Neverwinter Night server. And basically we could build characters all the way up to level 40 characters. And I would agonize over feat selection and all kinds of stuff on how to maximize this cool build at the end. I would spend lots of time doing it and then trial and error testing builds out. I just like to do that. I really enjoyed actually the theory crafting for this level 13 and building it. It was actually a lot more fun than when I was leveling up my character solely a little bit at a time, because it took a long time to get to the next thing. And by then I'd made a couple of choices that prevented me from getting something else that I figured out might be even cooler, you know?
Oh, that if you'd known about earlier, you'd have made different choices then.
Yeah. You know, and plus additional character options have been introduced since, you know, I started working on that and doing that and things like that. Now, I do have a 12-level rebuild boon I can use on a character. I'm just not sure which one I would use it on yet.
What do you want to do with it? Yeah.
Well, I only got the one.
There are, and there are people who love that. We had one friend in my old gaming group back in Illinois who was sort of, you know, well known for being like, oh, well, here's what I want to be taking at like 18th or 19th or 20th level, because that way kind of everything turns on and my character's awesome. And he's got every level planned out all the way up. And even when we're like, you know, Greg, this campaign isn't going to go past 12th level. That's as long as this campaign goes. Plus, characters die anyway. I mean, the part of the fun for him was being able to map everything out and knowing that he was working. Not only was he enjoying the character that he had, but he was working for something even better all the way along. Like, you know, fixed his sights on that star, and that's where he is going. And that's it's its own kind of fun. There are a lot of people like that.
Yeah. Well, in society play, you know, I'm on the second iteration of characters, and that's kind of the approach I'm taking now. Whereas the first iteration, you know, I have like five, maybe six characters at level 12, 13 now.
Oh, wow.
So now I'm doing new characters, and as I'm building them up, I have a target where I want to get. And so I'm much more deliberate, I guess, about the process, you know.
Trying to get from here to there.
But I'm also doing something a lot different. So, you know, than I did before. So being a lot more thoughtful about it than, my first character here, I'm, you know, it was a soldier. I'm going to go do this and I'll add this and this. Yeah. It's not optimized at all. And it's like, you know, I played against, played with other people in conventions and stuff. And I realized, man, their character's super powerful and do lots of cool stuff. Mine's pretty basic, man.
Right.
I need to do something different. So. I don't know.
Great way to learn.
I'm really excited. I think all of us mentioned this. You know, we're really excited about playing this new AP with these high-level characters. And, you know, it's like new toys.
It is. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I feel like there's a lot of sort of neat twists on combat. I feel like there's a lot of sort of fun with the a lot of the role playing that can go on. So I think there's going to be a real great place to shine. And I'm glad to hear that you also see that sort of people are kind of settled into being more comfortable with that kind of role playing, because I'm excited to have a lot more opportunity for it.
Yeah. No, I made this character much more deliberate about the backstory for this. Well, the other AP I was basically going to fill in for one book for you is what the initial goal was. So I wasn't as kind of committed to that character. This one, I think quite a bit more. And then, you know, Rob and I have tried to synergize our characters and our backstories and what we're doing. And then Eleanor's just been delightful in there with her role play. I had no idea how that was going to be, because every time I talked to her, she'd been pretty quiet. And now she's like, really, I really wish this were being recorded in person rather than online right now. I wish we could have done that.
Oh, right. Well, yeah, I think that there's, you know, but there's, it's not like our group's going anywhere. So
yeah,
someday we'll do it.
Yeah. I've been editing some of the final episodes from the previous book while we were in person.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much crosstalk and interaction between people and stuff like that, that we just can't really do online, because it's really one person at a time talking.
Right. Is that crosstalk distracting, do you think? Is it better? What's your opinion on that?
It makes the table seem, I can just visualize us sitting at the table and you can hear everything going on. It just makes it feel like you're right there.
You're part of the experience more.
Yeah, it really does, you know. And like when you and I talk, I mean, we have a little bit of crosstalk and it's not a huge deal, but when we have everybody, people have just kind of fallen into this online etiquette where when somebody's talking and they're talking, one of them will stop just so the other one gets to do that. And you can't have side conversations at all, right? It just doesn't really work.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I think that the further along we go through the pandemic, as things start to wane, I feel like that's going to open up more and push more towards that.
I hope so. As you know, as evidence from my recent history here, where I was exposed and my wife tested positive, and you know, we're living with this for a while. I hope it peaks and we get past it, though.
Me too. Definitely me too.
All right. Well, it's been great catching up, and I'm really excited about this new year, huh?
Neat. Well, we've got a lot in store that I think is going to be a lot of fun. So hold out for episodes 50 and later with us.
Yes, we're going to go past 50 for sure.
Yep.
I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination.